welcome to Worldwise. This is DJ Scrappy, and you're listening to radio.dominican.edu. I am glad to be here today, Friday, March 20th. I hope you are too. This is Worldwise, a show about science, technology, the environment, all things in between. And we have a really good show for you today, as we do every show. So, first up, scientists are seeking a ban on a method of editing the human genome. So this story comes to us from the New York Times. So a group of leading biologists on Thursday called for a worldwide moratorium on use of a new genome editing technique that could alter human DNA in a way that can be inherited. The biologists fear that the new technique is so effective and easy to use that some physicians may push ahead before its safety can be assessed. They also want the public to understand the ethical issues surrounding the technique, which could be used to cure genetic diseases, but also to enhance qualities like beauty or intelligence. The latter is a path that many ethicists believe should never be taken. You could exert control over human heredity with this technique, and that is why we are raising the issue, said David Baltimore, a former president of the California Institute of Technology and a member of the group whose paper on the topic was published in the journal Science. Ethicists for decades have been concerned about the dangers of altering the human germline, meaning to make changes to human sperm, eggs, or embryos that will all last through the life of the individual and be passed on to future generations. Until now, these worries have been theoretical, but a technique invented in 2012 makes it possible to edit the genome precisely with much greater ease. The technique has already been used to edit the genomes of mice, rats, and monkeys, and few doubt that it would work the same way in people. The technique holds the power to repair or enhance any human gene. It raises the most fundamental of issues about how we are going to view our humanity in the future and whether or not we're going to take the dramatic step of modifying our own germline and, in a sense, take control of our genetic destiny, which raises enormous peril for humanity, says George Q. Daly, a stem cell expert at Boston Children's Hospital and a member of the group. The biologists writing in Science support continuing laboratory research with the technique, and few, if any, scientists believe it is ready for clinical use. Any such use is tightly regulated in the United States and Europe. American scientists, for instance, would have to present a plan to treat genetic diseases in the human germline to the Food and Drug Administration. The paper's authors, however, are concerned about countries that have less regulations in science. They urge that scientists should avoid even attempting, in lax jurisdictions, germline genome modification for clinical application in humans until the full implications are discussed among scientific and governmental organizations. Though such a moratorium would not be legally enforceable and might seem unlikely to exert global influence, there is a precedent. In 1975, scientists worldwide were asked to refrain from using a method for manipulating genes, the recombinant DNA technique, until rules were established. We asked at that time that nobody do certain experiments, and in fact nobody did, to my knowledge, said Dr. Baltimore, who was a member of the 1975 group. So there is a moral authority you can assert from the U.S., and that is what we hope to do. Recombinant DNA was the first in a series of ever-improving steps for manipulating genetic material. The chief problem has always been one of accuracy, of editing the DNA at precisely intended site. Since any off-target chance could be lethal, two recent methods known as zinc fingers and TAL effectors came close to the goal of accurate genome editing, but both are hard to use. The genome editing approach was invented by Jennifer A. Doudna of the University of California, Berkeley, and Emmanuel Charpentier of Umeå University in Sweden. Their method, known as acronym CRISPR-Cas9, co-opts the natural immune system with which bacteria remember the DNA of the viruses that attack them so they are ready the next time those same invaders appear. Researchers can simply prime the defense system with a guide sequence of their choice, and it will then destroy the matching DNA sequence in any genome presented to it. Dr. Doudna is the lead author of the Science article calling for control of the technique and organized the meeting at which the statement was developed. Though highly efficient, the technique occasionally cuts the genome at unintended sites. The issue of how much mistargeting could be tolerated is a clinical setting. And a clinical setting is one that Dr. Dowd and his group wants to see thoroughly explored before any human genome is edited. Scientists also say that replacing a defective genome with a normal one may seem entirely harmless, but perhaps would not be. We're worried about people making changes with the knowledge of what those changes mean in terms of the overall genome, Dr. Baltimore said. I personally think we are just not smart enough, and won't be for a very long time, to feel comfortable about the consequences of changing heredity, even in a single individual. Many ethicists have accepted the idea of gene therapy changes that die with the patient, but draw a clear line altering the germline, since these will extend to future generations. The British Parliament in February approved the transfer of mitochondria and small DNA-containing organelles to human eggs whose own mitochondria are defective. But that technique is less far-reaching because no genes are edited. There are two broad schools of thought on modifying the human germline, said R. Alto Caro, a bioethicist at the University of Wisconsin and a member of the Doudna Group. One is pragmatic and seeks to balance benefit and risk. The other sets up inherent limits on how much humankind should alter nature. Some Christian doctrines oppose the idea of playing God, whereas in Judaism and Islam, there is the notion that humankind is supposed to improve the world. She describes herself as more of a pragmatist, saying, "I would try to regulate such things rather than shut a new technology down at the beginning." Other scientists agree with the Doudna Group's message. "It is very clear that people will try to gene editing in humans," said Rudolf Janisch, a stem cell biologist at the Whitehead Institute in Cambridge, Mass., who's not a member of the Doudna Group, actually. The paper calls for a moratorium on any clinical application, which I believe is the right thing to do, says Janisch. Writing in Nature last week, Edward Lanfear, and other scientists involved in developing the rival zinc finger technique for genome editing also called for a moratorium on human germline modification, saying that use of current technologies would be dangerous and ethically unacceptable. The International Society for Stem Cell Research said Thursday that it supported the proposed moratorium. The Doudna Group calls for public discussion, but it also is working to develop some more formal processes, such as the international meeting convened by the National Academy of Sciences to establish guidelines for human use of the genome editing technique. "We need some principled agreement that we want to enhance humans in this way or we don't," Dr. Janis said. "You have to have that discussion because people are going are gearing up for this," which I believe. This is DJ Scrappy here. You're listening to Worldwise. And we're not that far away from a future in which, we live in a world full of mass-produced organs. So modifying genes, I think, is going to be a big deal in the future. You're listening to Worldwise here on radio.dominican.edu. I'm DJ Scrappy. Thank you for joining me here. I'll be right back with you with some more Worldwise. All right, welcome back to Worldwise. This is DJ Scrappy here at radio.dominican.edu. Worldwise is a show about science, technology, the environment, anything else in between, pretty much anything that makes you say, oh, that's pretty interesting. You're going to hear it first here on Worldwise. So, I'm sure you've all heard about the Nobel Peace Prize, but this year marks the 25th anniversary of the Ig Nobel Prize, which seeks to, among other things, highlight some kind of wacky science, but also makes you think. So, let's dive into this story here. At first, Raymond Goldstein thought he'd received a spam email. The message to the Cambridge University physicist was asking for help working out the dynamics of hair. Specifically, the shape of ponytails. Goldstein thought he'd won the Nigerian lottery. Poised to click and delete, he scrolled through the message one more time and discovered it was from global consumer goods giant Unilever. Curiosity piqued, he met with a company rep, and the rest of that, as they say, is history. Excuse me there. Oh, gosh. Assembling a team of balding physicists, Goldstein set out to tackle the subject, publishing their research in a peer-reviewed journal. It detailed the fluid mechanics of hair, drawing on a rich seam of scientific observation stretching back to Da Vinci, of all people. They even coined a new term, hairodynamics. Attention from the scientific community soon followed, and within a year, they were collecting a Nobel Prize, an Ig Nobel Prize, that is, the prize you never thought you'd want. A satirical cousin to the more esteemed Swedish award, the Ig Nobel seeks to highlight research that first makes you laugh and then makes you think. This year marks the 25th anniversary, so what better time to celebrate the Ig Nobel's contribution to the research community? Every year, thousands vie for the award, always sourced from the cheapest materials, according to founder Mark Abrams, held at Harvard University. The ceremony is bathos at its finest. Winners receive their awards from genuine Nobel laureates, but speeches are curtailed by a screaming girl declaring her boredom. Each year, a cast of professional singers and scientists perform a mini-opera. Last year was set to Mozart and featured the chorus of microbial bacteria. Past recipients include a man who dressed up as a polar bear to scare reindeer and a study of homosexual necrophilia among mallard ducks. Commended by Abrams for its high literary quality. However, not all winners can have such scientific kudos. The Ig Nobel skewered the U.S. government in 2012, awarding them the prize for literature for issuing a report about reports that recommends the preparation of a report about the report about reports about reports. In 2009, the math prize went to Gideon Gano, then head of Zimbabwe's Reserve Bank, for printing a $1 trillion Zimbabwe banknote, while also printing a one-cent note. Last year, the Italian National Institute of Statistics landed the economics prize for bringing the country out of recession, through the use of prostitutes, drugs, and smuggling. The Italian government ended up setting a precedent in Europe, with the UK soon including the so-called black economy in its figures. National GDP jumped by 5% that quarter, equivalent to about 15 billion American. As proved by the Ig Nobels, the line between ridiculous and serious research has always been blurred. This is no better reflected than in Dutch-British physicist André Geim. In 2000, Geim scooped the Ig Nobel for biology for using magnets to levitate frogs. 10 years later, he went on to receive the Nobel Prize in Physics for his groundbreaking experiments regarding the two-dimensional material, graphene. It is hard to say which is the greater achievement. Abrams is currently touring the UK, touting the Igs, supported by previous winners such as Goldstein and potential candidates like David Dunstan, who found fame by conducting a 2-year study into the homing properties of garden snails. And his MO is throwing them over the garden fence. So, interesting. Soon, Abrams will have to settle down and sift through, he predicts, will be around 9,000 entries before the anniversary ceremony on September 17th. Despite his long-standing and much-admired prestige of the nobles of the Nobels, he is still yet to be invited to Stockholm for the awards proper. Asked if he would attend if offered the opportunity, Abrams demurs, saying he wouldn't want to be a distraction. And as for the Nobel Prize, could learn from his own mischievous creation? Absolutely nothing. So interesting stuff. Anyways, you're listening to Worldwise here on radio.dominican.edu. I am DJ Scrappy. And if you were with us earlier, we were talking about how scientists want to put a moratorium on retooling the human genome. And we just went over the Ig Nobels. Coming up next, there is a new crocodile, or I should say dinosaur, that was discovered, and it's named the Carolina Butcher. That'll be here on Worldwise when we come back. Yeah, come on, come on.
There's a day of feasting and a day of famine. Sadness and a day of joy, but you couldn't see in your day of feasting. Life isn't just a little play like toy. So your day arrived when you least expected, 'cause you always thought you were well protected. Feel like a fish out of water. So now you're wondering what's the matter. Oh, remember you said it couldn't happen to you. Now you're thinking how to start anew. Catch it, destroy. You and warned, but you wouldn't take heed. Everything in creation must obey a law. It's true in words as it is in deed. You want the puffed up in your bumps and reap what you sow. Simple truth everybody knows. Oh, what do you want an ounce of exile? Watching you now on your last smile. Oh, what do you want an ounce of exile? Watching you now.
All right, welcome back to Worldwise. This is DJ Scrappy here on radio.dominican.edu. You're listening to Worldwise here, and we are about to talk about the ancient croc that walked on two legs named the California Butcher. I know, you're scared already. I am too. Anyways, the California Butcher has been found and is just as scary as the name suggests. The scientists on Thursday said they have unearthed a fossil in North Carolina of a big land-dwelling croc that lived about 231 million years ago, walked on its hind legs, and was a top land predator right before the first dinosaurs appeared. Transported back to the Triassic period, what would a person experience upon encountering this agile, roughly 3 meter long, about 1.5 meter long tail beast with a long skull and blade-like teeth? Abject terror, says North Carolina State University paleontologist Lindsay Zano, whose group led the research published in the journal Scientific Reports. Climb up the nearest tree, advised North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences paleontologist Vince Schneider. The creature is named Carnifex carolinensis, meaning Carolina butcher, for its menacing features. It was a very early member of the croc lineage and was unlike today's crocs. It was not aquatic and not a quadruped, instead prowling on two legs in the warm equatorial region that North Carolina was at the time. It lived alongside armored plant-eating reptiles known as aetorosaurs, early mammal relatives, and other fierce predators such as the large, long-snouted, water-dwelling, four-legged phytosaurs. Carnifex is one of the most primitive members of the broad category of reptiles called crocodilomorphs, encompassing the various forms of crocs that have appeared on Earth. As one of the earliest and oldest crocodilomorphs, Carnifex was a far cry from a living crocodile. It was agile, it was a terrestrial predator, and it hunted on land. Carnifex predates the group that is living crocodiles belong to. The scientists unearthed portions of Carnifex's skull, spine, and forelimb, parts from a Chatham County quarry. They also created a three-dimensional model of the skull, filling in the missing parts with the more complete skulls of close relatives. Carnifex lived just before the appearance of the first dinosaurs, which started as modest creatures in the Triassic period before becoming Earth's dominant land mammals. Zano said Carnifex's discovery underscores the notion that before dinosaurs became well established in North America, such crocs and their cousins filled the large predator roles. While the dinosaur lineage eventually produced the world's largest terrestrial predators, it was the crocs and their cousins that typically were the Triassic tough guys. A group related to crocs called Rhysuchians. I'm going to say that one more time. Rhysuchians. See, here on Worldwise, we have a lot of scientific words, especially Latin, that sometimes they're just hard to say, like Rhysuchians. They were related to the group of crocs called Rhysuchians, included large four-legged land predators up to 8 meters in length, long, or more. So, a killer croc, which walks on two legs, and I believe there's I think one of the bad guys in Batman is named Killer Croc. And I think he fits the bill. Anyways, enough of that. You are listening to Worldwise. I'm DJ Scrappy. This is radio.dominican.edu. Let's move on from killer crocs to baristas. Because they're pretty similar, right? Just kidding. Anyways, science says chatting with your barista will make you a happier person. So we are social creatures. That does make sense. So this story comes from Business Insider. The key to happiness may not be as complex as it seems. In fact, research shows that people can boost their mood in several small ways, such as striking up a conversation with a barista. In a 2014 study published in Social, Psychological, and Personality Science, researchers Jillian Sandstrom and Elizabeth Dunn of the University of British Columbia found that the simple act of buying a cup of coffee could be transformed into a highly positive experience. Sandstrom and Dunn randomly assigned two groups different tasks in a trip to Starbucks. One was instructed to create a genuine connection with the barista via smiling, eye contact, and a brief conversation, and the other was told to be as efficient and impersonal as possible. Those who took just a few extra seconds to make a friendly small talk with the barista left the coffee shop feeling happier than they had when they went in. We found when people were assigned to have a real social interaction with the barista rather than getting in and out, they left feeling a greater sense of belonging. Don tells Business Insider. And humans are designed to have social interactions. These interactions are incredibly important for our overall well-being, and even the smallest ones can make a huge difference. Starbucks is not the only place you can go to boost your happiness, however, as Sandstrom and Dunn write in the abstract of their report. Every day, we have opportunities to transform potentially impersonal and instrumental exchanges into a genuine social interactions. The next time you're at a local coffee shop, supermarket, or bookstore, consider taking an extra 30 seconds to strike up a conversation, no matter how reluctant you may feel. The literature suggests that these little changes add up. So yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, chat up your barista. Now, if they want to do that race together thing that Starbucks is trying to do, I mean, that's great. That's great, and you don't have to be a scholar to talk about race. So, I guess I'm all for it. Give it a shot. This is DJ Scrappy. You're listening to Worldwise here on radio.dominican.edu. We'll be right back. Well, hey, oh, that was the wrong one. Sorry, my bad. Oh, but can I get you the right one? Can you hold on? Say please. There you go. We'll be right back.
Watch out.
Welcome back to Worldwise. This is DJ Scrappy here on radio.dominican.edu. That was Purity Ring with Lofty Cries. So, Worldwise, show about science, technology, the environment, everything else in between. Here for you and your enjoyment. Our next topic is about snakes and how they might have shaped your vision. Check it out. So, snakes might actually be the reason what we have acute vision. In a new paper published in the journal Primates, author William C. McGrew... I forgot to turn off that button. Or did I? I don't know. Anyways, let me just restart. In a new paper published in the journal Primates, author William C. McGrew, a former professor of evolutionary primatology at the University of Cambridge, reports a high rate of venomous snake encounters by his team of primatologists seeking to observe unhabituated wild chimpanzees in Mount Asserik, Senegal, West Africa. McGrew's snake encounters... snake encounter analysis in the paper Snakes as Hazards, Modeling Risk by Chasing Chimpanzees is one test of what's known as the snake detection theory of primate origins, a set of hypotheses that suggests we, along with primates, owe certain features of our evolution to the risk posed by death and injury from snakes. During the 609 days that make up the core period of the analysis, McGrew and his team encountered a snake in Asterisk on average once every 4.3 days, a total of 132 snakes. During the entire study period of 4 years, 142 snakes of 14 different species were identified. Of these, 64% were venomous, 33 were cobras, 27 were vipers, and 24 were rear-fanged snakes. In the mixed habitat of Asterisk, snakes were encountered in the forest twice as often by the researchers as expected by chance, at chance rates in the woodlands, and half as often as expected in the grassland. The dry season was considerably more risky a time for snake encounters than wet. McGrew acknowledges that the sample of identified snakes is pitiful by herpetological standards, but he also notes that the methodology was non-random because the researchers walked more in habitats preferred by chimpanzees, and specifies that no chimpanzee snake encounters were witnessed. So do these published data matter? Well, maybe. One encounter rate, McGrew writes in the paper, seems notably high, as does the proportion of venomous snakes. If anything, our encounter rate may have been lower than that of the apes, if party size is a positively correlated with snake detection efficiency, proxied by number of vigilant eyes. So the median party for the chimpanzees was 4, for observers it was 2. It's this notably high encounter rate that supports the snake detection theory developed by anthropologist Lynn Isbell. Isbell authored the 2009 book, The Fruit, the Tree, and the Serpent, Why We See So Well. In it, she explained some of her core ideas regarding snake detection. Here's an excerpt from it. We humans and other primates have our forward-facing eyes. We have our excellent depth perception. We have very good visual acuity, the best in the mammalian world. We have color vision. So there has to be some sort of explanation for this. primates in parts of the world with lots of poisonous snakes evolved better vision than primates elsewhere, Isbell found out. So that would be New World monkeys, or New World apes, as opposed to Old World. Actually, apes are only found in Asia and Africa, but monkeys are found in the New World and pretty much everywhere else. Back to our story. Isbell found out it's no accident that lemurs in Madagascar have the worst vision in the primate world. She says there are no venomous snakes in Madagascar. Last week, by email, Isbell elaborated for the StoryCorps two thrusts of her snake detection theory, or SDT. The first thrust develops the idea that constricting snakes were largely responsible for the origin of primates, some 70 to 90 million years ago. The second develops the idea that venomous snakes helped one lineage of primates evolve into anthropoid primates, the monkeys and apes, about 55 to 60 million years ago. In both cases, snakes would have helped generate changes in the primate visual sense that would enable them to visually detect snakes, which are often difficult to see since they're considering so low to the ground, better than other mammals could. Of course, better vision is clearly helpful in other contexts now, but the SDD proposes that the impetus for the evolution of better vision was the need to detect and avoid dangerous snakes that were and still are often difficult to see. Centrally, then, the SDT posits that the possibility of death or injury from contact with snakes was an evolutionary selection pressure that put our lineage on its path towards visual acuity and highly developed brains. I asked Isabel why other animal lineages were similarly affected, since surely other animals too would have encountered snakes. Ancestral placental mammals, she explained, were probably nocturnal, not active during sunlight hours. By contrast, the lineage leading to primates would have spent the day in shrubs and trees, where sunlight would have penetrated. As a result, that lineage could take advantage of sunlight to detect their predators visually, which resulted in an increased visual improvement over time. In the past few years, neuroscientists have been at work testing some of Isabel's specific hypotheses. Isabel writes, one of the hypotheses predicted that the pulvinar, a visual structure in the subcortical part of the brain, would be important in allowing primates to detect snakes quickly. An international collaboration of Japanese, Vietnamese, and Brazilian neuroscientists decided to test the hypothesis. Sure enough, they found neurons in the pulvinar in monkeys that fired more rapidly and strongly to snakes than to other objects, even monkeys' faces. So the threat detection on snakes is par none. And in another study, they found neurons in the pulvinar that are also responded more strongly to snakes that are poised to strike than to snakes in non-threatening postures. So not only can the visual system of primates zero in on snakes specifically, it's also highly sensitive to snakes that are more threatening. These are very exciting results. The heightened sensitivity of the pulvinar to snakes supports the main premise of the SDT, that snakes have long been very important to avoid, and thus for those in our primate lineage to see, and to see quickly. More field studies in primate habitats like Migroux's will, Isabel hopes, join with the neuroscience work in further testing the SDT. I cannot say SDT without saying STD. Anyways, taken together, the findings from primatology and neuroscience regarding the SDT may help explain why many of us react strongly to the sight of a snake. Our response may be deeply ingrained, even when the chances of encountering a poisonous snake are quite low, and when comparatively speaking, the risks of most of us from snakes today just aren't very great at all. If you startle or otherwise react strongly and rapidly at a snake sighting, then just consider yourself a well-evolved primate. Very interesting stuff here on Worldwise at radio.dominican.edu. This is DJ Scrappy. And if you are just joining into us, we just went over how snakes may have played a part in our visual acuity. We also talked about the Carolina Butcher, which was a new crocodile, ancient crocodile that has been found that walked on two legs back in the Triassic period. And before that, we talked about how scientists want to put a moratorium on genome manipulation. When we come back, we're going to go over cosmic dust and where scientists believe it comes from. And going along with that, we're also going to talk about the solar eclipse that just happened. And if we have more time, we'll go on to how Microsoft is phasing out Internet Explorer. Stay tuned for more. This is Worldwise, radio.dominican.edu. right, welcome back to Worldwise on radio.dominican.edu. This is DJ Scrappy. If you're just with us, or if you're just tuning in, we just went over how detecting snakes may be the cause of why we have such great vision. And now we're going to talk about cosmic dust, and I know you're all super excited about that. So, cosmic dust, containing elements like iron, carbon, or oxygen, plays a key role. Sorry about that. Plays a key role in the formation of planets and stars. Let me just restart for you. Yeah, cosmic dust plays a key role in the formation of planets and stars. As you've heard from Moby, we're all made of stardust, right? But early galaxies consisted only of gas, and the dust appeared later. Where the dust came from has long been a mystery. After years of searching, astronomers have observed cosmic dust that appears to have survived the hot aftermath of a supernova. The finding was reported in the journal Science. When a supernova explodes, it forms a bunch of dust, says Ryan Lau, an astronomer at Cornell University and lead author of a new study. But dust is pretty fragile material. So the question is, who's to say that dust survives this extremely hot, violent environment? And if it does, how much? Using infrared images from an observatory aboard a Boeing 747, Dr. Lau and his colleagues located a supernova remnant near the center of the Milky Way with substantial amounts of cosmic dust. We're seeing a 10,000-year-old supernova, the oldest supernova found with dust inside of it, he said. According to the researchers' measurements, about 7-20% of the dust mass initially formed survived. The findings suggest not only that cosmic dust in the earliest galaxies could have been formed from supernova, but that more of the dust survived than many experts had expected. Pretty interesting stuff. So let's move on from stardust into solar eclipse. So there was the solar eclipse last week. And if you were in the Middle East or parts of Russia, then you would have seen it. So since we're here in America, let me just tell you about it. People throughout Europe, as well as parts of the Middle East, Russia, Africa, Asia, and South America, got a stunning view of a partial solar eclipse today. A very few lucky ones at sea and in the high Arctic caught a glimpse of the same event as a total eclipse, as the moon passed in front of the sun's disk. Sky and Telescope magazine wrote earlier this month that although the path of totality is quite wide, maxing at 462 kilometers, that's 287 miles roughly, this total solar eclipse suffers from two important disadvantages: lack of land in the path and poor weather prospects. First landfall of the Umbra occurs in the Faroe Islands, a small archipelago of 18 surprisingly green exposures situated northwest of Scotland and halfway between Iceland and Norway. The New York Times states that cloud covered the sky over much of northern Europe, including the Faroe Islands, one of the few places where the total eclipse was expected to be visible. Some places, such as Berlin, were lucky enough to get a view of the spectacle under clear skies. As an aside from that, Reuters reports that several countries in Europe claimed success on Friday in managing the unprecedented disruption of solar power from the two-hour eclipse that brought sudden massive drops in supply, which is startling. The AP says Germany, Europe's biggest economy at the heart of this event, boasts the world's biggest solar power installations, which last year supplied 6% of national power requirements. The initial 13 gigawatt drop in Germany was less than operators had feared, and they were able to draw on an alternative power sources, including coal, gas, biogas, and hydroelectric energy pumped from storage. For our North American readers who are feeling left out, your opportunity to view a total solar eclipse comes August 21st, 2017. This is Worldwise. I'm DJ Scrappy. Here on radio.dominican.edu. UCLA.edu. For those of you just tuning in, we have about 10 minutes left in our broadcast. Next up, we're going to talk about Internet Explorer. You know, the operating platform that you use to get on the internet, if you use it at all, since there are so many others and better ones. And we'll also be talking about President Obama and what he wants the government to do concerning emissions. So stay tuned, and hopefully we'll be back for more. Or rather, you know what? Let's just get right into it. So, Microsoft is phasing out Internet Explorer. I don't know if you remember Clippy from Microsoft Word. He would help you with your papers and all that. Barely, but he helped. Anyways, Clippy will soon get a new roommate in Microsoft Heaven. Depending on your perspective, this week Microsoft announced that it will phase out Internet Explorer, its much maligned web browser, beginning with Windows 10. The news came at the Microsoft Convergence conference this week, when marketing chief Chris Capossela announced IE's replacement, Project Spartan. That's still a code name and will likely change, but there are some things about Spartan that seem to be already set in stone. It will come with a personal web assistant called Cortana and special reading mode, a more streamlined layout, and new annotation tools that work with keyboards or pens. Internet Explorer will linger on for a bit, though, in Windows 10. Some versions will keep the option to use IE in order to work with older programs and devices. MIT's Technology Reviews says IE's end can't come soon enough. Internet Explorer, first released in the mid-1990s, dominated the browser market at its peak in the early 2000s, but it came to be associated with poor security and compatibility with other browsers and has since languished. Spartan's success is critical if Microsoft is to remain relevant in the web browser business, a market in which it used to dominate but now trails Google's Chrome. According to data from StatCounter in February, Chrome had 43.2% of global browser market. That includes desktop, mobile, and other platforms, while Internet Explorer captured around 13.1%, and Firefox had 11.6%. Microsoft has some troubles shaking off Internet Explorer's legacy. For starters, IE should have gone a long time ago. Putting Internet Explorer to bed is something that makes sense for the company now, says Christina Monlos from Adweek. In fact, it even may be an overdue move. Monlos added that ditching IE alone won't be enough. Microsoft will have to overcome the stigma left behind. The Internet Explorer brand is so tainted, she said. When you think of Internet Explorer, the first thing you think of is that it's slow, or that still exists. Monlos said it will be very easy for Spartan, even though it's new, to be stuck with those types of opinions. Which, of course, you know, it's hard to shake off. They don't want people to think, they don't want people to see it, that they're just putting lipstick on an Internet Explorer pig, says Monlos. And on top of that stigma, Microsoft will be trying to convince millions of IE users, as well as those who have moved on from Microsoft web browsing software and might not be willing to come back. By introducing a new browser, you're asking people to change their daily habits, Monlos says. If someone is used to Chrome or used to whatever they use, they probably don't want to change. Of course, for all the celebration about IE's demise, it's still a very popular program, controlling by some estimates almost a quarter of the desktop browser market. And there are some fans that are, you know, sad to see it go. After there was a call put out on Facebook, an email came back from Kim Cower, who runs two small businesses in Michigan. She said that the news came as a shock. It freaked me out, she said. It's all I use, and I don't like change. Cower said Internet Explorer is actually faster than the other browsers she's tried, like Firefox and Chrome, and she said it's the only browser compatible with all the accounting software she uses at work. Even though IE will still be available to her for some time, Cowher said she's still going to take a little time to mourn the browser's impending death. I'm thinking a good martini with anchovy olives will be appropriate. And she said she'll put off upgrading software or buying new devices if it means she can keep Internet Explorer. I'll hang on to my old stuff as long as possible. Well, Kim, good luck with that. That's about all I have for you today here on Worldwise. It is 11:56. Our show ends at 12. I know I told you I was going to tell you about Obama and the government's emission cuts. I guess I'm a liar. But I will leave you with a song. This is DJ Scrappy. You're listening to Worldwise on radio.dominican.edu. Catch us again next Friday at 11 to 12 to hear more about science, information, the environment, technology, and whatever else your little heart desires. Adios, folks.
Them rhymes, rugged and rough, but that won't sell, cause you gotta keep it real, so that we can feel where you're coming from, because these streets is ill, so if you ain't killing niggas in rhymes, your whole sound's just bubblegum. I said I won't contribute to genocide, I'd rather try to cultivate the inside, and try to evolve the frustrated ghetto mind, the devil and his army never been a friend of mine, but niggas don't wanna hear that shit, said the brother who was obviously totally misled, and yelled out murder, murder, kill. Murder instilled in the influence you lost on his head. Shallow days, you never wanna let a brother be a brother fully in until the outer caught up. And all them hollow nights, you can't escape cause everywhere that I look, people frontin' and it just ain't right. Shallow days, you never wanna let a brother be a brother fully in until the outer caught up. And all them hollow nights, you can't escape cause everywhere that I look, people frontin' and it just ain't right. I said, don't you know the powers of be are using people as pawns, devouring we until they see us all gone. The scene. And as a pastor chronic, he said, look at where I be. I tried to get a job for real, but all the homies hit licks and rob and steal and keep fat pockets caught in the rut to catch round this ways in. Plus, who could you trust? I said, I'm all about protecting mine, but neglected minds be getting left behind. Why don't you change your environment? He said, this is all I know. Plus, my fam's all that I got. I can't go. I said, you gotta make it for the fam. Damn. He said, I didn't make the ghetto. The ghetto made the man. I said, you more than just that. Shook his hand. Said, damn, we gotta find a way to break the devil's master plan. Shallow days, you never wanna let a brother be a brother fully in until the outer caught up. And all them hollow nights, you can't escape. Cause everywhere that I look, people frontin' and it just ain't right. Shallow days, you never wanna let a brother be a brother fully in until the outer caught up. And all them hollow nights, you can't escape. Cause everywhere that I look, people frontin' and it just ain't right. The word peace is just an expression used to say bye when it's time to jet. And them red, black, and green medallions was all just part of a trend. I guess hardly ever see them around brothers' necks no more. Instead of that, go gats aspiring gangsters and Max who at the young age of four. You seeing more drama than war veterans instead of learning God's laws. And hip-hop is a voice, so we enlist that to express how we be feeling about this and that. But music does reflect life, and kids look up to what you're portraying and mimic what you act like. It's time for a new day, an era in rap, conscious styles, making them aware of the happenings. But the ears seem more steered towards self-annihilation, so many might laugh and write this off like I'm out here just blowing wind. Maybe label it soft or unreal, something they can't feel.